Appalachia. Nobody truly knows where the word came from, but it seems that most folks have their own idea of what it is. Everything from run-down mobile homes full of meth heads to beautiful mountaintop views. The Appalachian Mountains are the oldest mountains in the world and once stood over 30,000 feet into the air. They span the eastern North America from Canada through 14 states all the way to Louisiana. Hello, I'm Larry Bentley, and I was born and raised in these very mountains. I, for one, know that they're a source of unending tales and adventure. I also know that the views of an Appalachian as to what happens outside these mountains is a bit different than one might think. Join me as we take a journey through these old Appalachian mountains and beyond. I think you'll be surprised at how it goes. Welcome to Season 3 of Appalachian Murder, Mystery, and Legend.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
How you doing, good friends? Glad you stopped by today, and thank you so much for listening. Now, this one is a mite short, but it's a good one. Back when I was a young feller, there was a movie released called Jeremiah Johnson. I remember my dad taking us all down to the drive-in theater to watch it. And it was the old Autodrome, as it was called, and it's since been turned into a place where folks can rent themselves a little storage room to cram all their extra stuff in so they won't trip over it while trying to get through the house. Kind of keeps everybody from everything from looking like maybe you're teetering on the edge of becoming a full-grown hoarder like you see on TV. Anyway, that movie, if you've never seen it, is a really good one. It's about a man who takes to the mountains to live what we call today off the grid. One thing I wondered right off the bat was if the story was based on a true one. And sure enough, it was loosely based on a true story. And most of the time, Hollywood versions are over the top and out the window with overblown scenes that are just, you know, too fantastic to have ever happened in the true story. In this case, Hollywood was the one that didn't go far enough because the true story is wilder than anything they could have come up with back in the day. So sit on back there and stay a spell and let me tell you all about this one. Now, John Jeremiah Garrison was born in Little York, New Jersey in July of 1824 to Isaac and Eliza Garrison. He had five sisters and a brother who would go on to die in the Civil War in a battle in Virginia. So he grew into a huge man, about 6'2" tall, back when the average height of a man was about 5'6". Jeremiah, as he was called, was also about 260 pounds, when everybody else averaged about 100 pounds less than that. His father was a raging alcoholic and nearly worked the poor boy to death. His father was hard on him when he was a little feller, and that's what made him a full-grown mountain of a man who was capable of doing just about any kind of violence known to mankind if he needed to. To top it all off, his father would send little Jeremiah to other farms to work off his debt. So Jeremiah finally got tired of being treated like a slave and took up working on a whaling schooner, hunting whales. Of course, he was too young to be doing that, but he was so big for his age, nobody knew any better. Working on a boat, running around the ocean, chasing and harpooning whales got pretty old after a few years, but all of that work is what actually built him into the 260-pound man he grew up to be. It's said that he didn't have an ounce of fat on him anywhere. So, right at the start of the Mexican-American War, he joined the Navy. As it turned out, being a sailor wasn't all that he thought it would be either. By then, he was pretty impressive and didn't have a whole lot of self-control and a raging temper to top it all off. from the way he was treated when he was a little feller. But when a lieutenant whacked one of these fellow soldiers with a sword, which wasn't uncommon back in the day, Jeremiah punched him in the neck, which laid him out cold on the deck on the ship. And when the lieutenant came to, he didn't know exactly what actually happened, but he thought it was Jeremiah who punched him. Because he was suspected of striking the superior officer, he didn't get any shore leave for about 30 days. So when he finally did go ashore, he just didn't come back. And during wartime, that made him a deserter. And the military, like they always do, came after him. Desertion during wartime was punishable by firing squad back then. They'd just drag you to straight back, stand you against a fence post, and a 12-man firing squad will let you have it. So if you're going to run for it, you blame well better make it, or you're going to end up with more holes in you than a piece of Swiss cheese. First thing he did was head out west to Montana. He'd heard that they were finding gold out there, and he figured that he had about as good a chance as anybody else of finding it. The second thing he did was pick up the name Johnston, and later drop the T in that name, turning it from Johnston to Johnson, and he stopped using his Jeremiah as his first name, and used his actual first name, John. So it's hard to imagine a man like John Johnston just blending right in with folks half a foot shorter and 100 pounds lighter than him, but somehow he managed to pull it off. Probably didn't hurt none that he got a job as a wood hawk. And that, my good friends, is the same job as a fireman would be on a steam-driven train. The only difference being that he was chunking wood into the boiler fire on steamboats instead of scooping coal for a train engine. That meant that he was all stuffed down in the engine bay where hardly anybody ever saw him. After chunking wood for long enough to save up enough money to be able to not have to chunk wood anymore, he bought mountain man supplies, meaning traps, a rifle, knives, and different things that he could use to make it in the wild, and headed off to the mountains. He was lucky enough to meet up with another older man named J.X. Beadler, who helped show him the ropes and try to teach him a little bit about living out in the mountains. Now, being that the Northwest Rocky Mountains are dang sight different from living in the Northwest Northeast Appalachians, don't get me wrong, both can kill you if you don't know what you're doing, but there's a great difference in the threat you face and the critters that you can meet. So after he got it all figured out with Mr. Beadler working with him, they managed to do pretty well trapping furs and hunting game for food. Every so often, they would take the furs down to the nearest trading post and trade for more supplies. They really didn't have a whole lot of use for money. It ain't like you can go down and buy yourself a mess of rabbit from the bear on the corner or anything. So while on a jaunt into the Adler Gulch territory of Montana to do a little trapping, Jeremiah met his future wife, who was a member of the Flathead Indian tribe. Now, the name Flathead, of course, came from the white man as a name for the Salish and Kootenai people of the area. They were referred to as Flathead because some of them used a method of binding the cranium of the children to deform the skull into a flattened appearance. Today, it's thought that it was done so that members of a certain group could clearly identify others of their same group or family, because it's not all of them did it. Wasn't long before Jeremiah and Swan, as she was called, were married and living in a log cabin that Jeremiah built from the surrounding trees. He was now known as an official mountain man. Here he'd just be called Appalachian, I guess. Mountain men back then were men who'd left society behind most of the time for some nefarious reason or another and went on to the mountains to live off the grid. Most of them ended up dead because they ventured into Native American territory, and that just didn't go good for them. Jeremiah and Swan were soon expecting a baby, and it looked like he'd started making a good life for him there in the mountains. His old trapping buddy, J.X., would stop by and visit as he passed through from time to time, and at that point, Jeremiah Johnson was pretty good friends with the Flathead, the Blackfoot, and the Crow Nations. Of course, I wouldn't be here talking about things if that kept going like that, would I? Folks, you ain't heard nothing yet. Stick around. I'll be right back. You're listening to Appalachian Murder, Mystery, and Legend with Larry Bentley. One day in 1847, when Jeremiah was out hunting and running his traps because, even in the mountains, a family got to eat, that's when a group of Crow warriors attacked his cabin. They killed his wife and newborn baby. Then they burned his cabin into a smoldering hole in the ground. It may have been business as usual for them to go out and clear out any white men they found along with their Native American wives, that they were married to, but they soon found out that they should have just probably left this one alone. Jeremiah, still having a temper he was known for, was so enraged that he vowed on the spot to track down and wipe out the entire Crow Nation, right up into the chief and his family too. For some reason, he didn't have a whole lot of trouble hunting and killing the Crow people. It was easy for him. I say it was probably because he was born and raised in the mountains to start with and pretty much lived there most of his life by then. Now, what he did with them after he killed them is another thing. After he killed them, he scalped them and then cut out each man's liver and ate it raw right on the spot. He'd learned that the liver is especially important to the Crow people. They believed that they needed it to cross over to the afterlife. So by cutting out their livers, without the greatest surgical precision, I might add, and eating them, Liver-Eating Johnson, as he was now called, wasn't only ending the Crows' lives, but he was ending all their hope of an afterlife on top of that. And that ought to send a message, I'd think. At some point, while he was tracking, killing, scalping, and eating liver, he managed to get pounced on and dragged off by a group of Blackfoot warriors who were fixing to trade him off to the Crow. They figured that he ought to be worth a right smart bounty to them. They stripped him to the waist, tied him up with leather straps, and left him in a teepee with a guard until they could go cut a deal with the Crow. Despite being tied up and with raw hide straps, he managed to get loose and knocked the guard out cold. He then scalped the man, cut off one of his legs below the knee before running off into the woods with it and the scalp both, where he smoked the leg and the jerky and ate it. Then he did leave the man with no hair in one leg, but still alive. No word on whether he managed to heal up without infection taking him out, but there are numerous accounts of people in the day surviving a whole lot worse. Of all things, while Liver-Eating Johnson was running through the woods chewing on leg jerky, he ran right into his old trapping partner, J.X. Beadler, who helped him out. After that, apparently the Blackfoot were added to his shit list because he went back with a load of homemade biscuits to trade for him being left alone. There were 29 Blackfoot warriors that told him that it just depended on how good the biscuits were. What they didn't know was that the biscuits were laced with strychnine. He then stood and laughed at them as they went through the spasms and twitching of strychnine poison until they all died, which took a good 2 or 3 hours to fully play out. Liver-Eating Johnson kept his killing spree going for the next 25 years, striking fear into the hearts of the Crow and Blackfoot people, and to the point where the mere mention of his name sent people into complete panic. That was until he just finally let it all go and decided to make peace with the Crow and the Blackfoot. Liver-Eating Johnson killed, scalped, and ate the livers of over 300 of the Crow Nation during his tirade. After making peace, Liver-Eating Johnson moved on. He joined Company H, 2nd Colorado Cavalry of the Union Army in St. Louis in 1864 before being honorably discharged after the war. Nobody in the military ever figured out that he was the one that punched a superior officer in the neck and ran off. After his service, he moved to Colson, Montana, and was appointed deputy sheriff. Later, he became the town marshal of Red Lodge, Montana. Through the years that followed, he made a living by doing a few different things, working as a sailor, but of course not for the Navy. He went back to being a hunter and a trapper for a good bit. He was also a builder, gold digger, whiskey peddler, and a tour guide. At one point, he was part of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. That was until he wound up in a fist fight with Buffalo Bill right in the middle of the street just after a show one night. One thing that was odd, though, he wouldn't eat liver anymore, no matter how it was prepared. Said that he just couldn't stand the taste of it. I guess when you've had enough of something, you, by golly, had enough of it. Eventually, he ended up in a veteran's home in Santa Monica, California, where he died of old age. He was buried in Los Angeles Veterans Cemetery on January 21st, 1900. Now, normally, that would be the end of the story for a normal person, but apparently we just ain't talking about a normal person here, are we? In 1974, 2 years after the release of the popular movie Jeremiah Johnson, a group of 25 seventh graders led a six-month campaign to have his body moved from Los Angeles back to Cody, Wyoming. As it turned out, they were able to pull it off. They organized a disinterment and a reinterment ceremony, complete where Robert Redford, who played the loosely based liver-eating Johnson character, he actually filled in as pallbearer. And today, liver-eating Johnson still lies in peace in Cody, Wyoming, one of the places where he made his living and earned his nickname. So I hope you got something out of our story today. It's another one that needed telling. If you have, please rate and review the podcast. Don't forget to follow us so you can get notified of new episodes. Come join us on Facebook and the Appalachian Murder, Mystery, and Legend podcast group where we talk about everything Appalachian or whatever else you want to talk about. I'll be back real soon with another Appalachian Murder, Mystery, or Legend, and I will see you then.